So we're going to lower the lights and I'm going to start. So welcome everybody. Thank you for coming out through this treacherous weather to our brown bag lecture today. My name is Larissa Bailiff and I know a few of you by sight. But again, I want to thank all of you for coming today to our talk on Jacob Lawrence's migration series. And I was asked the question by someone who was entering, why I picked this topic or why now. Well, I do want to say it's Black History Month in February. I propose a topic in the fall because the Jacob Lawrence series, as we'll discuss, or at least 30 panels of it, are up on our fifth floor gallery. So our brown bags often are meant to pertain to our collection or some aspect of it, and I'm very excited that the panels are still up there, and I'm going to encourage all of you, probably several times throughout the talk, to go up and see them if you haven't seen them or see these old friends, so to speak, because they really are marvelous and slides just can't do justice. So this is just one of the panels, number 40 there. And here they are, as you can see, but without flash, it looks a bit dim. But I do want to show you this image before you re-go upstairs to look at them on the fifth floor. Just to give you a sense, because we're going to be looking at individual panels, some of the experience of the dialogue that's created between the different panels. Even though you can't see the individual images at this point, I just want you to understand that some are horizontal, some are vertical, and there's a play and a momentum that we'll discuss, sort of stops and pauses along the way, but dialogues that are formulated between the works. And we'll talk more about the process and how he sort of unifies them. But let's start at the beginning, the very beginning, and that is the sort of history of Jacob Lawrence. And we see in this quite quaint photograph there a family portrait, if you will, of Jacob Lawrence when he's six with his mother, Rose Lee, and his siblings, William Hale and Geraldine, in about 1923 or so. And next to it, I've put an image done in tempera on paper. Tempera is the paint that he likes to use the most, and we'll discuss that. His image, Moving Day, aka Dispossessed. And while he doesn't ever say that this is specifically his family, I think we get a sense of a sort of autobiographical memory of his early childhood days there with an older brother, probably Jacob, holding on to all the family's possessions, and a sister, probably Geraldine, holding up her little baby brother who tugs at the mom, working so hard with brooms and all kinds of cleaning supplies. And even if it isn't Jacob Lawrence's own family, this is something that he was exposed to and experienced, you know, throughout his own moves and, you know, seeing the people around him, particularly in Harlem. We don't get a great sense, the idea of dispossessed, kicked out of one's home, moving around. And this mother here has to struggle with a lot with her three children. That was the case for his mother, Rose Lee. In fact, his father left the family in 1924 when he was only 7 years old, so she was dealing with all three children, not an easy feat. By the age of six, he had already moved from three different cities. He was born in 1917 in Atlantic City. He moved to Easton, Pennsylvania, and then to Philadelphia. When he was 13, he moved to Harlem. His mother had actually left him and his siblings with relatives in Philadelphia. She went to Harlem to try to find work and spent 3 years there before she could raise enough money to bring Jacob and his siblings on up to Harlem. So think about the sort of notion of movement even in that. The Great Migration series, of course, has to do with the migrations of people coming up, as it was called, rural laborers and families from the South to the North. Now, while he wasn't born in the South, his mom was born in Virginia, his father in South Carolina, and he did move around a lot before they ended up in Harlem. And he certainly was exposed to it in stories of people. He talks in Philadelphia about poorer families coming up all the time and how they would stretch out their, you know, meager food and share with others. Some photos of Harlem in the 1930s. He arrives in 1930 there, and just a street scene with kids playing, just like Jacob would have done. And next to it, you know, what might look like, you know, a random photograph there actually shows a place that was really important to Jacob Lawrence. This is the Utopia Children's House, and this is where his mother put him after school to keep him out of trouble, as she said. And I don't think she ever sort of reconciled herself with the fact in the end that he became an artist. In fact, she just wanted to keep him occupied. She died in 1968, and although she was very proud of him, she said, I wish he hadn't become an artist. That said, this is where he was first instructed in art and, you know, kept out of trouble. by drawing and painting, and he was exposed to tempera paint, the cheapest of the paints, but it's something that he continued to work with, media throughout his life. He did try other things, but the paintings that we'll look at are done in tempera. He showed an early interest in art, you know, in his teens, not only drawing and really amazing people with his talent, but he would walk the 60-odd blocks to get to the Metropolitan Museum. I would love to say he came to MoMA, but we know that he definitely went to the Metropolitan Museum and looked at works running the gamut from Arthur Dove to Giotto. I want to say, by the way, that neither of these two works happened to be at the Metropolitan, but they exemplify the kinds of things that he was looking at. He loved, as he said, early Renaissance painting, particularly Giotto here. But above all, he loved the Mexican muralists with their interest in monumental figures, figures, struggle, humanity, narrative subjects, and that's what he will pursue throughout his life in terms of his own art. So we can, I think, see even in these what he was drawn to. But think of him, 14, 15 years old, 16, walking all the way to the Met to expose himself to these things. He did have some training. He trained with Charles Alston and some other teachers at the Federal Art Project Workshop in Harlem, and this was part of the Works Project administration. Later, a couple years after this, he was hired on to paint easels. He was never hired to paint murals. As he said, he was too young to paint a mural. He was of the next generation, but he was given a little bit of money to paint easel paintings. But it seems as if his vision couldn't be contained in sort of single images, and that's why he begins to work on these great narrative series very early on. So he does receive some instruction, but he's very much self-taught as well. His first major narrative series, which is done in his early 20s, is Toussaint Louverture. Who was, if you're not familiar with Toussaint Louverture, he was a slave in what becomes Haiti, and in fact he led the revolt that led to the founding of the first republic in the Western Hemisphere. So he was incredibly instrumental in terms of Haiti becoming Haiti and overthrowing the oppression of the French. And we just see two images here, you know, him riding, and later when he's actually captured, he's betrayed by the French and imprisoned. But he did 41 panels for this, and you can see that he wants to storytell, and he wants to give us this vision in multiple images. These are done, again, in tempera.
He paint tempera on wood?
Those are actually tempera on paper, and as we'll talk about the Migration series, which he originally entitled The Migration of the Negro, and we're just calling the Migration series, it you know, became that shortly thereafter, are painted on a Masonite board. So he did paint on different things. The Masonite board, you know, a sort of mid-century, 1920s invention, sort of newfangled material. You would have to gesso, so to cover with a base, and then he could paint over it. And that's what he seems to like using the best. But that's a good question. Here we see him. I'm sorry this isn't black and white, but you're looking over his shoulder. And looking on one of the scenes from the Migration series, and already from this, and I'll actually show you what that image looks like. They're all the same size. They're 12 by 18 or 18 by 12. As I said, some are horizontal, some are vertical, and they don't alternate, you know, one after another, but there is a sort of pattern to them. And here you can see this is an image number 44, which has to do with the better living conditions in the north and the fact that there's more food. So we get this wonderful close-up, and he alternates a lot between close-up and aerial view and giving us these different perspectives, but you can see him sort of working on that. And you also see the scale of the 12 by 18 and the fact that all of the panels are this size. So it's a very sort of intimate scale for a very monumental series. He completes them within 6 to 8 months from start idea to finish. There are 60 panels total.
Mm-hmm. What is that, a ham bone?
It's like a ham, a slab of meat and some bread and cheese with a knife. Yeah.
And so yes. Something
Yes, and Soutine,
you know, contrast.
Yes, I'm glad that you bring that up. I mean, just because we can compare a lot of his works to other influences. And of course, I've brought up early Renaissance and Arthur Dove, some American art. But certainly he's looking to European modernism, and Soutine's work, particularly in the 1920s, would have informed his still lifes. So he's culling from lots of different sources and making them very much his own, which I think is one of the most wonderful things about Jacob Lawrence. He knows what he's seen, and he draws from all these sources. So thank you for bringing that up. So again, he finishes this in an astounding 60 panels in 6 to 8 months from start to finish. His soon-to-be wife actually helps him gesso the panels. They dry very quickly, so they're quick to do, but that's still a monumental feat. The topic, of course, is, as I said, the great migrations of Southerners, African-Americans, to the North, which begins immediately after the Civil War, but really picks up around 1910 and sort of explodes after the First World War. And so it's a historical subject. And while Jacob Lawrence had been painting sort of genre scenes of the community in Harlem, much like that Moving Day, a.k.a. Dispossessed, during the 1930s, he turns to subjects like Toussaint Louverture, to a series he does on Harriet Tubman, to Frederick Douglass, so the woman who led the Underground Railroad, to Frederick Douglass, the first abolitionist, and then he turns his scope to another historical moment a little later in time, to these mass migrations. So he's very, very interested in history and the African-American struggle. And he goes to the library at 135th Street and studies at what becomes the Schomburg Center, and he pores over sociology, history, and literature. He's reading Emmett J. Scott and W.E.B. Du Bois and all kinds of sort of accounts, but very historically based, of these migrations that have been ongoing. He's not just storytelling only, although he adds to that his own personal experience of movement, what his parents have told him, and what he's seen of people all around him. He considers himself a griot, a storyteller, and we see that reflected in his pictures, but he adds to that this notion of historical specificity. One of the interesting things that the librarian there says is that he came every day and he studied and he wrote and he, you know, made notes before he ever came up with this series, but he didn't look at photographs, and I think it's interesting that his visual memory was from other things. You know, either people that he'd seen and met or other art. And he could, you know, draw on his imagination from the things that he was reading. But it was very much based on statistics. And I think that's very interesting about them. So they're filled with social and historical meaning. Here another subject, I should return to that just for a moment. We see the types of workers, you know, toiling in the fields around the same time period that he's painting this, 1940 to 1941. He's 23, by the way, when he does this series. Here we see people piling up all of their belongings, kind of like his mom, picking everything up, including the kids and the chairs and anything they can sort of bundle up and take with them. Just one story, obviously, there, that family, but going from Florida to New Jersey. And this telling picture, you know, of the bus station. So people are walking, they're taking the trains, which is a major motif of the migration series by Lawrence, but bus. Are you looking at the poster there?
It's amazing.
I have to say, yeah, this is a really, I brought it up when I gave this talk on Monday. This right here, Hitler's Love Life Revealed. So we digress for a second, but it really is, you know, of the moment, the sort of popular posters and what was going on. But of course, for us, you know, the more telling thing is the bus, the notion of transportation and migration, and colored waiting room, which puts us back into that place where things were very different and the kind of conditions that you know, people were working through, African Americans in particular. So he does all this research, he comes up with his ideas, and he creates the migration series. First he's going to do 40 panels, then he realizes it needs to be bigger, he makes 60. I'm showing them in their first installation in 1941, and again, I'm sorry that it's not a color picture, but they didn't take any at that point. This is at Edith Halpert's downtown gallery, which was no longer downtown. It had moved the previous year to 51st Street, so quite near here. It had originally been downtown, and that's what gave it its name. One of the important things for us is that it was a major gallery, and it's the first time an African American was represented by a major gallery with this type of show. in 1941. So Edith Halper was instrumental in spreading modernism. She represented at times Stuart Davis and Ben Shahn and many other American modernists. And she became very interested in Jacob Lawrence's work, even though he was, you know, only 23. And in fact, I just want to show you this, and then we'll go back to the installation shot. This is the month before she had actually convinced friends of hers at Fortune magazine to do a write-up on Jacob Lawrence's migration series. And she printed, or they printed, I should say, images not of the 60 panels, but at least of 26, and wrote a several page, this is only two pages of that spread, including the first page, and the migrants kept on coming, which is the refrain from his last image. And so, you know, really celebrating Lawrence and exposing the American public to him. So she was instrumental in wanting to promote him and really believed in his art. Well, we'll talk about it in terms of this. I mean, his Toussaint Louverture series, I should say, actually was shown in Baltimore in 1939. So, and actually again in Chicago. So he was, you know, beginning to get interest in his works of art. But this was really fundamental in promoting and selling his art. And the Migration series was his real breakthrough. And we'll talk about who bought it in just a minute. So I want to sort of go over the idea that we have 60 panels here, that they're done in this short amount of time, and you know, that they take on this very, very epic social history. They were purchased to get to the idea of sale. Or I should mention one thing before the sale, and that is the date here, December 1941. Edith Halpert had actually tried to organize this major show of, as she called, American Negro art. She was good friends with Alan Locke, and he had written a book about the idea that you know, American Negro art you know, needed to move forward out of the Harlem Renaissance and really become filled with this modern language. And to him, Jacob Lawrence really encapsulated this. So Edith Halpert gathered together this idea of a show and pulled together all these artists to show with Jacob Lawrence. They were going to have this wonderful opening in December 1941. That month might ring a bell. The night before the show was supposed to open, Pearl Harbor was bombed. And so there wasn't quite the response that she wanted in terms of that. Fortunately for us, you know, one person who was able to see the show was our director, our first director, Alfred H. Barr. And so he came several times to look at Jacob Lawrence's work and wanted to purchase the series. Another person, Duncan Phillips, from the Phillips Collection, also wanted to purchase these works for his institution. And so Jacob Lawrence had said he didn't want the pictures split up. He wanted them kept as 60 and not sold individually. But in the end, and he said he wanted $2,000 for them. And in the end, MoMA took 30, and the Phillips Collection took 30. So they didn't go quite the way he wanted, but they were preserved in a unity. And even in seeing the Fortune magazine spread, he told Edith Halpert that he was rather pleased, that there was enough of a dialogue between the works. And as we'll talk about, the story doesn't exactly go from start to finish, so you're not disrupting that. It's better if it's 60, but he was happy to have two major institutions purchase his work for $2,000 total. Which doesn't seem like very much, but of course, if we change the rate, it's little better than it sounds. I just want to point out again in this installation, it's interesting, you know, with the sort of domestic space there, you know, the way in which we see these pictures again in black and white, but we see them already from the flash of the MoMA installation now from 2010, and we see it in Edith Halpert's, that it doesn't necessarily have to be shown one way or another. He didn't designate that you have to show them all in a row or that you can't hang them on top of each other.
Did you just say?
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Did you just say you're putting it up?
It is up. It is up. I'm sorry. Oh. It is up right now. I apologize. I didn't understand your question. Yes. So it's on display at MoMA right now. It's part of our permanent collection. We have 30 panels as we acquired in 1942, the year after they were made. So thanks for clarifying that. I'm sure other people are wondering about that. So, in fact, this is what it looked like when we showed them in the 1940s. We showed them in 1942, and then we showed them again in 1944. And in between, they were shown at the Phillips and actually all around the country at 14 different venues. So a lot of Americans were exposed to them. And I think this looks very different than the installation in Edith Halpert's gallery there. They're sort of one after another. Just to talk about, you know, why Alfred Barr and Duncan Phillips, one of them so very much, and what they represent before we begin to look at them in color. And that's the better way to look at them. But Alfred Barr wanted to get his hands on them right away because he recognized in them this epic poetry, this way of the importance of the social history being told, but not in a social realist style. He really appreciated the way that Jacob Lawrence was wedding together what was already mentioned, a sort of modernism that we can see coming from Europe and manifesting itself in American artists like Arthur Dove and others, Sheila, but also pulling from Soutine, you mentioned, Matisse, and certainly Picasso. Jacob Lawrence himself called his style dynamic cubism, and we'll see if that sort of bears out, but it speaks to the fact that he thinks he's speaking and is speaking a modern language, but he's bringing that together with a storytelling that doesn't leave behind narrative. And no other artists at this moment were really creating anything like this in extended series, in a narrative that was updated in that modern language without sentimentality or without some of the overt propaganda. So it was really quite monumental and amazing, and Barr recognized that. Why did we take the panels that we did? We actually took the even panels, and the Phillips collection has the odd ones. In fact, it comes down to this image here, number 46. And we'll talk about the captions in a minute. You can read them if you want. I'll read a couple of them. But one of the trustees who was paying for these in 1942, and again, they were snapped up less than a year before, a year after they were created, the trustee fell in love with this image of a staircase. And so Barr brokered the deal to get all of the even ones. So it wasn't based on, a particular theme running throughout. It was just decided that we would get the even, they would get the odd. So I just want to talk a teeny bit about process. And we're looking at the first work in the series. I would love to show you all 60. I'm probably going to show you too many. It's hard to resist. They're all so wonderful. But this is the first, and in fact, they are numbered and sequenced as if storyboards. There's an almost cinematic quality as you go through. And it might be interesting to go through the Tim Burton show and notice some of his storyboards that he makes and how very different that is, but based on the same sort of premise of an unfolding story. And yet it's not just one story. It's many stories and many people's stories. They're numbered. Use my pointer here. They're numbered, as you can see, over here in the corner. So that is number one. He put these frames on them, so they come sort of self-contained, if you will. They're Masonite board. He framed them. He put the numbers on them. But even before he did that, when he was coming up with the idea of the 60 panels, he wrote captions, inscriptions for them. And that's what he started with. So he wrote all those out for all 60 panels before he did anything, based on his research, some of them two sentences, some of them one sentence. And then he came up with these pictures for them. He had the ideas for all of his panels before he ever started painting. He did drawings for his panels, and then he would transfer them. So he would do a piece of paper, put his drawing down, correct size, and attach it and trace it through. So it would be on top of the gessoed board. And then he could make changes, as he liked to keep a little spontaneity afterwards. But that was his process. But the most fascinating thing about his process of all, I think, is that he drew out the pictures that he was going to do, and then he used that tempera paint. And tempera is known for its sort of bold colors. He didn't mix any of these colors. And it's very sort of plain-spoken, very matte. And he painted one color on each panel. That is to say, he would paint all the yellows on all 60 panels. Imagine that he filled up his entire studio with all of the panels. It's a very unusual working method and very modern, I think. He actually started with the darkest colors first, he says, and then went to the lightest, but whatever it is, red. Red panel, red panel, red panel. Why did he do this? Well, one of the reasons he said was he wanted all the reds to be the same. He wanted it to be unified, and I think we have to understand that in terms of all 60 panels, having this unification, this solidarity, if you will, and the sort of dialogue with each other. So during the world, there's only one world war that he's talking about at this point, even though we've entered into World War II. During the World War, there was a great migration north by Southern Negroes, and that's what we start with. I want to read a little bit of a poem by Langston Hughes, One Way Ticket, which was actually written in 1948, and the migrations don't stop obviously, and in 41, but I think it's really apropos here. I pick up my life, and I take it with me, and I put it down in Chicago, Detroit, Buffalo, Scranton, any place that is north and east of Dixie, right? And we have that sense here, maybe not the same names of the places. In fact, probably these were the three centers where people flocked to most, and that's based on the information that he's getting. Chicago, New York, St. Louis, right? And in fact, I'm just going to feed you a couple requisite statistics to go with this sense. In 1910, no less than 75% of all African Americans lived in rural areas, and 90% lived in the South, right? Between 1890 and 1910, the black populations of New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Illinois more than doubled. That of New York nearly tripled. And this period that he's really focusing on, around World War I, between 1910 and 1920, the black population of New York increased 66%. And between 1920 and 1930, it expanded 115%. So that's a lot of numbers, but these are all human stories. And this is the kind of statistics and facts that he's thinking about and trying to represent in this very epic way. So we see the streams of people, ever-flowing streams of people, filtering in to these places. People with all their belongings, perhaps dressed in their best, moving off in these mass flows of migration. And of course, I turn to the last of the series, and I'll show you some in between, but the last of the series, number 60, and the migrants kept on coming. So in fact, he doesn't end the story, they come to New York, or they make it to Chicago, and what happens. In fact, what we have throughout the series is a sort of journey, but with fits and starts, momentum building, and then pauses. We see causes for the migration, and we see interspersed with images of people traveling and trains, as we'll see. And, then we get to conditions in the north, and some of them aren't too pleasant. You know, he doesn't sugarcoat this. He doesn't make a happy story. But he does emulate a story of journey, of the journeys of these people. And they didn't always make it somewhere right away. And when they got there, the conditions were hard. Yeah. Okay.
The migrants.
Uh-huh.
To me, migrants is like people that go from cherry orchard to cherry orchard
okay.
and don't stay in one place. Weren't these people looking for a home?
Yes.
Weren't they looking to put down roots?
And sure.
Why they come to
because them? For them, I didn't go through this myself, but I think you know, we're talking about different terminology here. And for him, he didn't find the word migrant offensive. The notion of migration is about picking up one's home and trying to find something new. And these people were. They were picking up their belongings, and they were lured sounds too seductive, but they were encouraged by increasing industry in the north and better conditions and for living conditions and education, and wanted to make new homes and better homes for themselves and for their children. And what I mean by they didn't always end up in New York first, he ended up in Philadelphia first and then makes his way to New York. I'm not saying New York is the promised land, but there is also a notion that, further north, further east, further west, I should say, you're getting to something better and better. But what he's saying is it wasn't always like that, and the struggle was hard, and these people didn't have a lot of money. In terms of the notion of migrants, and I'm getting the sense maybe that you feel this is not what they're doing. I mean, it was called by people at the time the migrations. But one of the things, I just want to say, and then I'll let you speak, one of the things that Alfred Barr talks about in bringing this into our collection, and by the way, it was the first art of an African-American to enter into our collection, that's a really important point, in 1942, he said that the spirit of these is universal, and we can argue about the language, but that it would be universal because anybody could recognize suffering, struggle, travel, but particularly anybody who had immigrated to the United States or been forced to move during the Depression or any of that, that the notion of the migrant experience, that anybody could understand that. So I totally understand your interpretation of migrant, and that I think that is a very good definition of a part of what the migrant experience is. But he's not saying in any means that these people aren't trying to find a home. Yeah. And I think underlying this as well is the notion that many of these people come from the South and were enslaved there. So this migration started in Africa.
And they worked the land, like migrant workers.
They were migrant workers, which... You're right. So it coincides with what you're saying in that a lot of them had to sort of move around, or they were used to having to move away from their families, the husband or wife, to sort of...
And they were going from rural to urban.
And they were going from rural to urban, exactly. And we'll continue to talk about that, and you know, the word migrant will keep coming up, but you were right that these people are mostly laborers, they're migrants, and sometimes their life is more transitory, certainly than they want it to be, but they're moving in the hope of better conditions. I just want to suggest and keep sort of picking up, and we'll talk less about these individually, perhaps, but more about what he's doing with them. Again, this notion of sort of repeated themes, particularly in using a very simplified palette and very sort of strong but simple forms. Again, we're sort of seeing themes that sort of are varied as we go along. So we see the people waiting at the station, going somewhere. We see the train. We see the tracks. And again, these very modernist views to give variation, but to, they're, you know, the panels, the series is peppered throughout with the idea of travel. You know, clickety-clack. It's almost as if we can hear it.
These are simple pictures, but also these people were not educated as well, so they were also simple people moving on.
Well,
it's very powerful.
I think what you're saying is, yes, they're very powerful images that can speak on many different levels. And I think they still do today, whether it's, you know, any kind of audience. But particularly children pick up on these right away. But again, we're talking about instant sort of recognizability that people can identify with travel, with tough conditions. They're waiting. They're traveling. They're crammed into trains. You know, and of course he's showing us this with different views. I mean, this is an incredibly modern way of showing this picture, which is antithetical to sort of social realism and other types of representation. I mean, look how the figures are, the sort of roundness of the figures. We, you know, all of these are heads, sleeping figures, a mother nursing her child. That's humanity, but played off against this wonderful sort of modernist grid and beautiful patterning, if you will. The theme of wood itself gets played out again and again. So it's wood at the train station. It's wood of fences of buildings that we see. It's wood that is the train car floor. And then it's wood that is the walls of the buildings, etc. So there are motifs that run throughout to sort of show us what this journey is about. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You had shown an earlier slide that made Alpha Bar one the other group.
Yes.
It's very similar.
I'm so glad that you picked that up.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I'm going to speak to both your points, and this is wonderful, and this is why I wanted to give this talk, because, I mean, and I don't even need to give this talk in a way, because the works speak for themselves, and you're responding to the power of them, but I'm going to go on anyway. But what you said, Jacob's Ladder, I think, you know, and Jacob, of course, it's his name, and they called him Jake, but the idea of Jacob's Ladder was an important one and a very spiritual one for many people, particularly in the South, and something that they held on to, the idea of climbing up the ladder and ascending. You know, Booker T. Washington had written about it, and the idea of climbing up that ladder and bettering oneself. And so this is vertical in a very modern way, but it also relates to what you said, number 46. Actually, this is 6, and then 46 comes later, but you would see that, and if we could see all 60 panels together, you would see these motifs that go from railway cars to the hard labor conditions in the North, in fact, which is what that was about. But it also echoes this idea of, you know, the Jacob's Ladder and ascension. So, and again, if we repeat those colors, you know, here, just moving us to the North, and I sort of go back and forth like his series does, although I've changed the numbers a little bit, he talks about the cramped conditions, again, in a very sort of modernist style with these iron rods, you know, intersecting with the composition and making this very radical perspective on the room. But he talks about, even, you know, in his housing in the North, they were small, cramped conditions, and it wasn't that much better. And I think the sort of play of, you know, the experience of being cramped in a train, not that much different than what they found when they got there. But of course, the colors also add to this wonderful sensation of patterning, and I think we're captivated by some of the beauty of it. It's vibrant at the same time that he's able to tell us that things were difficult. And you know, you're picking up on again, some of the dialogues and associations between the works, and there are many, many more. He also reflects later, looking back at his series and saying, wow, I had a lot more symbols in there than I thought I did. And I think that's interesting, you know, that you think about, I'm working so hard and I think I know what I'm doing, and then actually there's more in there and different things. I put these side by side. This is number 7. The Negro who had been part of the soil for many years was now going into and living a new life in urban centers. And, of course, that's exactly what we're talking about, the migrant experience, first having to move around in the South and then moving up north. And yet it's such an abstracted image with those wonderful, vibrant colors. And whether it's picking up on the sort of decorative tradition and storytelling tradition of quilt work from the South, and, you know, that could be it. I mean, it looks like streaming ribbons. Or he's showing us what the migrants are seeing, or the African Americans, the Southerners are seeing as they, you know, look from the train and they look at the fields. I put it up against a photograph, again, that he wouldn't have seen, perhaps, but actually a film still from a film produced around the, you know, 1930s, which I just find absolutely fascinating in terms of the way in which the garment, the bag, becomes the person, and how, of course, how stooped over and bent. I mean, this is toil and work, but it's also a fascinatingly abstract image of the worker. And, of course, this is what they're trying to sort of escape. And yet I think there's some correspondence in the abstraction that he gives us there. And yet we're not really sure. I mean, is that cotton? It looks like cotton, but is that they're thinking about the South or they're leaving it? But at the same time, I'm going to throw in another Langston Hughes poem really, really quickly. A new type of Negro is evolving, a city Negro. Forgive me, I'm writing the wrong poem. Worldwide dusk of dear dark faces, driven before an alien wind, scattered like seed from far off places, growing in soil that's strange and thin, hybrid plants in another's garden. And I get this sense that whatever that image is, it's a compilation of what you're leaving behind, of person as soil. This idea that Langston Hughes presents, and Jacob Lawrence loved Langston Hughes' writing, the idea that you become a hybrid plant when you move. You're looking for home, but you get to Harlem or someplace else, and there are other factors, and you need to change and grow. And it's not just an instant fit, but that notion of the connection to the soil never leaves, and we even get that metaphor of the person as seed. But I want to continue and just show you a few more works. So, you know, he can do total abstraction, where we're sort of searching for what exactly he's alluding to, and yet it's absolutely poetic and evocative of an experience, or he can give us a monumental figure. And stakes and nails, you know, the notion of sort of the power, the tools, but also the simplicity and the difficulty of it, starting from the ground up, is a theme that runs throughout as well. And of course, I think when we look at this image, we can't help but think of notions of John Henry and labor. He also shows women laboring, so the difficulty. But he can make it into an abstraction, molten steel, that stands for work itself. And look at that absolutely radical perspective there. I mean, it's breathtaking. And yet, imagine how hot, how difficult, how treacherous working on the railroad would be. Something that a lot of people were forced into just to pay for their tickets to get up north. Scarcity of food, the sharecroppers, their difficulty. I think anybody can identify with the sparsity, the scarceness here. And again, the nail moving from one image, it's the spike of the railroad. The other, it's the only thing holding up their singular pot. Some of the most interesting and poignant images are of children. And of course, many of these people are trying to better the lives of their children. Here we have, I think, an image that in some ways is a bit tension-filled, because we have the wonderful sort of decorative quality of the baskets there, and something, again, that speaks to a Southern tradition, an African-American tradition of making beautiful, decorative, vibrant, colored things, and yet filled with cotton, they burden the children, and it's work, work, work that we see in, you know, the many different baskets here. And I also want to point out here that I think he's looking at, again, different sources, like Egyptian art, we see in the figures turned in profile. But if we get away from the visual, we have to think about the meaning, the burden of the difficult work, how young these children are. And I won't read through the captions, but again, you know how important these were to him as he created them. to sort of tell the story as well. But we go back and forth, other conditions, so injustice, and I think the shackles on these three figures, which so interestingly line up and don't line up with the verticals, you know, in the background there, the wonderful play of verticals, the strong verticals in this image, but the shackles, of course, would remind everyone of the slavery in the South and the pre-Civil War slavery. But as Lawrence and others would attest, sometimes going up north was another economic slavery. And I think that is probably one of the most powerful images that he gives, the lone huddled figure, thinking about whether it was time to leave or not. Certainly not an easy thing to do, but absolutely dynamic and modern, with that sort of bifurcated image there, cut in two with that sweeping, wonderful diagonal, which actually, in fact, may go all the way back to Giotto, whom I showed you, who loved the sort of sweeping diagonal, the early Renaissance, the figure turned with its back to us. This is, to me, and you'll have your favorites from what I've shown you, but also the ones you look at upstairs, one of the most beautiful images that he gives us. Number 9, another great ravager of the crops was the boll weevil, right? And if anybody, does anybody come from down south? Okay. My stepmother does, and if you mention the boll weevil, I mean, anyone coming from the south, it's not just the stuff of legend. It would wipe out entire crops. And, you know, so not all of the conditions that he's talking about are injustices or terrible things that were happening or privations, but in fact natural disasters that would wipe out the crops and the economic conditions. And yet there's something about this. If you took away the caption there and just looked at this image, it's quite stunning and quite modern. They don't look exactly alike, but one might compare it to George O'Keefe or Milton Avery or Arthur Dove, and the interest in different perspectives on nature. And I think this loses nothing going next to a Georgia O'Keeffe. I know, and even the bugs, those terrible, terrible little boll weevils, don't look so bad in their abstracted form here. And yet, anybody seeing this, having come up north, would recognize how devastating that could be. Again, the notion of storytelling, bringing people up north, making the choice. And I just want to mention when Lawrence arrived in Harlem and met up with his mother, gets off the bus, he said he was astounded by seeing these beautiful buildings so high. He'd never seen things with 7 or 8 stories. And I think some of that sort of amazement here, not everything was great or the promised land in the north. You get inside and they're cramped and small. And, you know, he said his mom and others all throughout Harlem sort of decorated their little teeny apartments with rugs for the carpet and the walls, and that's where he picked up on these patterns and these bright, vibrant colors, because everyone wanted to make things seem more homey or more beautiful or better than they were. And I think some of that sort of patterning and vibrancy that he saw around him in Harlem and as he walked all around gets manifest in this image. But again, if I were likening it to anyone, I didn't bring in the slide, but we might think of Mondrian, is that what you're mouthing over there? Yeah, Mondrian, or you know, anybody with color blocking and abstraction as he crops the building. So we don't see, you know, the great 7 stories, but we're brought immediately into the middle of it. So since we're in the north now, although again, that train goes clickety-clack, that journey sort of bringing us back and forth with people's decisions to come up north and what they're facing, you know, some of his images look almost a little more comic, but of course they're underlined with, you know, great difficulty and I think disappointment, disillusionment. The Harlem Renaissance was over by this point because most of the artists and writers had taken off from Harlem and left because economically it was so difficult. Here, discrimination continues, and he shows us that, you know, by the whole room being cordoned off and the wonderful exaggeration of the vertical format. And this, the Harlem death rates, the mortality rate. And again, I'm speaking of Harlem because that's where he was, but of course he could have looked at any statistics in Chicago and St. Louis where they had great riots and things like that. There was tremendous violence, there was economic upheaval, and the death rate was much higher because there was a great deal of tuberculosis and bad conditions. So children died and people died, and they said that the best job, most consistent job to have was undertaker. And here we get it in a powerful statement of these three almost sort of conical figures there, and we can tell that they're deeply religious, and of course the church was so important in Harlem during this period. But there's that wood again, right? And those vibrant colors. But the wood now is not the railroad. It's not the walls of the house. It is used for a coffin.
That
yeah.
That picture is remarkable in its geometry. Mm.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Barbara Hepworth.
Yeah.
So it reminds you of Barbara Hepworth in terms of the figures themselves and the, yeah, I mean, again, I think there are resonances, and the interesting thing is this is 1941, so I think we get sort of cross influences. So, you know, he's influenced by artists from Europe and America, and then he in turn influences artists from other places. But you're absolutely right to point out, and the simplicity of the palette, I think, exaggerates that. I mean, but he makes the choices, and he could have told these stories in any way that he wanted to, but they're powerful, and they're simplified, and they're absolutely epic, and remember that they're like that. So, of course, one of the last images, and I'm going to wrap up very shortly here, in the North, the Negro had better educational facilities. This is an image that teachers love to use. And, of course, it's one of the most inspiring, and one of the reasons why people came North, to better the lives of their children, that Jacob Lawrence could do better than his mother did, and Geraldine and William Hale, and all of the families that came there. And it is inspiring, and again, he uses geometry and the way our perspective looks. 2, 3, 4, they climb higher and higher. Maybe that's an older girl, but the way their bodies stretch and reach give us that sense of the possibilities, that Jacob's ladder that's, you know, at least symbolically sort of behind a number of those different images. Here the wood again, the back of the, you know, supporting the blackboard and people's hopes pinned on, in this instance, three girls, much better than three older women mourning someone in a coffin. But I think one of the interesting things about this particular work is, as inspiring as it is, and as a reason that people came up North, he says, in the North, the Negro had better educational facilities. He didn't say everything got better or that everybody triumphed. So it's a subdued kind of statement. It's rather objective all the way through, even though some images are more inspiring than others. But of course, we end with the migrants who are still coming because they didn't stop in 1941. And the story goes on just as he's talking about thousands and thousands of people. You know, it comes full circle, or the journey continues, clickety-clack, clickety-clack. And I want to just bring us back to our dim picture to encourage you to go upstairs and see them in the full light, to see these vibrant colors, which PowerPoint can't quite do justice to, and to see these 30 panels, as we don't have all 60, but I think there are wonderful associations and dialogues. You'll see the images we looked at today, and I hope that I've conveyed to you, and I'm appreciative of all your comments and questions. In just a minute, I just want to say, because it has helped our dialogue, just as I think Jacob Lawrence's story is informed by lots of different things as well, and I think, you know, again, with the captions, with the epic poetry, they do, in fact, you know, speak for themselves. Yes?
What is the chemical composition of tempera, and will it have the life expectancy that oils have so that these can continue on?
It will. Originally, tempera, you know, beginning in Giotto's time, was an egg-based material, so it was egg and the pigments mixed in, and those have lasted to this day. His has a something called casein, and it's actually a slightly different binder, but it's long-lasting, and I mean, everything has to be conserved and preserved, and it's not like we have to have it in special light or anything like that. I mean, one has to be careful in terms of storing it. It will come down eventually. We do reinstall from time to time, but it's going to be fine. It's not like you know, experimental material. It's not like some things that a lot of contemporary artists are using today, sort of playing around with stuff.
And even acrylics don't have the staying power, according to my artist friends, that oils do. So
true, true.
I was just curious, especially on a board, it would absorb better on paper. I would think those would be very fragile.
Right. As far as I understand it, they're in fine condition. And I'm not an artist myself, and I haven't, you know, painted in these materials. I mean, there is a gesso, so there is a base down there. I mean, I think, you know, and we don't have glazing or glass over them, so, I mean, it is always an issue. There's no glass, yeah. As far as I know, yeah. So, you know, I mean, yes, their life expectancy is not forever. You're correct about that, but it's better than if he experimented. And yeah, as far as I know, it's pretty, not sufficient, but it's pretty durable. Are there any other questions? Yeah.
Where's the Haiti piece?
Right now, they're actually traveling in Texas. And I'm forgetting where their base is, and I shouldn't know. But I know that they're in Houston right now on display. I don't know where theirs are right now, and I apologize. I mean, I know he has works all over. I know he was in, you know, Seattle working, where all of his series have ended up. I'm not quite sure. Yeah. And I can, I can pull up my book. The one I have on me talks mostly about the migration series. I didn't bring my Toussaint Louverture. I actually looked in my Toussaint Louverture book recently to figure out where they were housed.
He's in the Met too, isn't he?
He's all over the place. Yeah. Yeah, exactly, that he returned to the Met. And for those of you who aren't as familiar, I mean, he went on to do many historical series. He also, one of his claims to fame is that he was one of the five painters of the inauguration when Jimmy Carter got inaugurated in 77. And he's the only one who painted the crowd and didn't paint Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter said it's the people's inauguration, so he painted people up in the trees and bundled up in the cold, and it's wonderful. It's got a light blue background and reds and the trees and all of that. And Jimmy Carter said it was his favorite because it showed exactly what he wanted. He also, when Pope John Paul II was asked to pick an American artist to be represented at the Vatican, he picked Jacob Lawrence and picked one of his series of builders. He did a lot of series later on of workers and people constructing. So, yeah. So go enjoy them or go re-enjoy them. And thank you so much again for coming and for all your comments as well.
Thank you.
It's a gallery show just a couple months ago over at... 157th with Jack Levine in Philadelphia, and he knew Jacob Lawrence, and they had a few of the migration series on the wall. I want to say, do you see more? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I didn't go to that exhibition, but...
But it was there, yeah. You must have gotten the drawings back and mounted so you could put them
floor. Like I said, they've been up for several months. So if they were from our collection, they may have been in storage and then they sent them over there, but they might have gotten those ones from the Phillips. Yeah. And they do travel from time to time. One of the things I didn't say is they've been reunited in 71 and 93 and 2000. The Whitney showed some.
Yeah.
And the Whitney showed in 2000, I think they showed all of them. In 2007, they showed 17 of them. And they do travel from time to time. Or Jacob Lawrence will have they'll have a show of his work. He died in 2000, but they'll have a show of his work, and so, you know, a couple will be there to exemplify it.
American.
Yes, yeah.
One of these.